Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So, what does it mean to be a modern warrior? First off, the elephant in the room. Warrior isn't a dirty word. A warrior is mindful. They seek excellence and have learnt to control their aggression. It's about understanding leadership, developing individual resilience, and seeking consistent human optimization. Remember, lifting heavy isn't dangerous. Being weak is dangerous. Fortune favors the brave, and you're never given more than you can handle. This, then, is the Warrior U podcast. All call signs. Ready, ready, ready. Let's roll! Boom.
Hey, how you going?
Good, how are you?
Not too bad. Sound all right?
Oh, you know, look, it could be better.
Could be better. I'm doing it via Instagram.
G'day,
everyone.
It's better than the podcast that the Taliban have.
Don't they use Al Jazeera?
That's a good call. How are you, Trent? How is everyone?
I'm well, mate. Yeah. Pretty good. Can't complain. Yourself?
Great. I'm good.
Where's this podcast find you today?
I am in wet Perth today. Yes,
I'm in sunny Adelaide.
Enjoying some rain. We've just had a 10-year, you know, once in 10-year storm for the 30th time this year.
Yeah, right.
So that's been good.
Once in 10 years.
Yeah. Hey, so yeah. Let's get into it because we've got an hour. So, today we are going to be discussing recent events in Afghanistan, topical at the moment. And I guess straight up front, just a disclaimer, I want to start by, you know, simply pointing out that all of the views on the podcast, anything that we say today, they're my views and your views. We may not even agree, I don't know yet. And they're certainly not the position of the Australian Defence Force or the government. They're just our views. And some of these views will probably be, you know, some of the information will be quite factual and some of our views will be philosophical. Yeah, and then the reason for this podcast is simply to capture, I guess, our thoughts and align some of our thinking with the Warrior U leadership podcast tribe, just to try and align everyone. And anything, I guess more than anything, it's just a conversation and a dialogue around events to perhaps give people some perspective or some thoughts on the matter.
Well, there's a lot of people talking about it, so it's, yeah, topical and timely, I think.
Yeah, and one of the really interesting things around sort of stoicism or the warrior culture that we like to talk about and being a modern warrior is being able to remove yourself from some of the stimulus and be an outside observer and observe the facts and try not to be emotionally triggered by events. So taking a godlike, you know, view where you're up over it all, looking down and just looking at it from the perspective of the human condition and perhaps looking at it from an observer's viewpoint rather than being, this is about me. Well, let's not. I'm going to make it today not about me. It's not, which is unusual.
Objectivity.
Which is unusual in a podcast.
Objectivity.
Yeah. Yes. There you go. That's sort of our disclaimer up front.
Hey, firstly, Bram, many people that have read your book obviously know your operational experience. How about you tell those that are listening? Those that are live with us on Instagram and those listening to the podcast after, Tell us about your experience, and then I might drop mine or lack of it where it's relevant.
So from an Afghanistan perspective or army perspective?
In general operational experience, you know.
My very first deployment in the army was to Somalia in 1993 as a 19-year-old, and certainly didn't have any empathy at that time because youth makes you impervious to things that are happening around you, actually. That sort of set the scene for me, and then trained pretty much whole adult life within the ADF, so reconnaissance mostly, special forces for 15 years, on the tactical assault group, couple of tours to Afghanistan, couple of tours to Timor, and then a few other roles and tasks within Afghanistan outside of the usual special operations task group tours. I was there once as an operations officer. I was there once as a platoon commander, Yankee Alpha of 2 Commando Regiment, and also went to the Coin Academy there. So that's the counterinsurgency academy that's there. So yes, I've had a lot to do with Afghanistan in my later years as an officer in the army, and operational experience as a soldier before that. So yeah, so I think I have certain things to contribute. I also studied international relations, majoring in societies. So a lot of what I focused on was actually Afghanistan, so that it would make me a better leader when we went over there. And on my last tour in 2010, we were, and 2007 actually, 2008, one of those tours, we were actually there securing the elections, free democratic elections. And that was part of our roles and tasks. Another job that the guys did was to move huge turbines to the Kajaki Dam. And then something I spent a lot of time doing in my last operational tour was working with the Afghan National Army and the police force. And after that, I was then an advisor to the Mentoring Reconstruction Task Force before they left to go to Afghanistan. And anyone that knows you and I, they'd know that a lot of our stories around leadership, I say, they have been tested in the laboratory of combat, that's a pretty extensive time there, to discuss these things, I think.
Yeah. Hey, that's pretty extensive. And of course, whilst there are similarities that many people have when they serve, there's also quite significant differences. So, for instance, despite my, 10-year in the Army, I've not been to Afghanistan. So I'll put that up front, that my observations and impressions are not based on my own personal experience in Afghanistan, but my operational experience started with similar to yourself, really, but again, not the same. My time in Rwanda, which is quite well documented, from a historical perspective. I spent, I did an operational tour in East Timor as an intelligence officer. And went and assisted your unit on the border during the elections in East Timor.
Mm.
And I've actually spent a significant portion of my sort of post-full-time army time as a private security contractor, including 18 months in Iraq during, between end of 2004 and through to mid 2006.
Yeah.
So it was quite a warm time there at that time. But, Papua New Guinea, Indonesia, Solomon Islands, those sorts of places.
Mm.
So that's my experience. A lot of other, leadership experience and training experience in civil military cooperation, psychological operations, joint ops planning, those sorts of things. So that's my background. For those that are listening live on Instagram, feel free to drop in your questions and we'll try and get to them if we can, and if it's sort of an appropriate time in the conversation, we'll bring you in.
Yeah, there's some guests on there who are very respected, so I'm not going to name you all, but there's some people in this group who I have the utmost respect for, and and also the spouses of some people who I have the utmost respect for. Listen, let's start straight off the bat. You know, why did we go to Afghanistan? You know, there's soldiers in the army now who weren't alive during September 11.
Right.
Bloody hell. And
it's mind-blowing, isn't it?
You know, I guess just to finish on our experiences, you know, I left Australia and left the army completely and went and worked in the UAE to help raise the desert warfare capability and have worked with, with the Emiratis who actually contributed a lot to Afghanistan, I might add. The Emiratis, they spent a lot of time in there. And so I also have a view around Islam, I guess, from first-hand experience. As do most soldiers who've been to Afghanistan. So why do we go to Afghanistan in the first instance? Well, September 11 occurred and the world changed. Everything changed. My world certainly changed. Yours changed. Our kids' future worlds have changed. The soldiers in the army today, you are a product of that changing global environment. The United States responded very swiftly. It should be added that the Prime Minister, John Howard, was in New York when this happened. So it affected him profoundly. And I think Leighton Hewitt was there as well from memory. I remember those sort of things. People remember where they were. I was in Timor at the time, across the road from a huge army. A huge Muslim army, the Indonesians. And that was a scary couple of days for us. We're like, are we at – because Samuel Huntington wrote a very famous thing, Professor Huntington, called The Clash of Civilizations, where a few years prior he had actually said that what we would see next is not war between nation states, but a clash of civilizations. And again, whether that comes true in the future or not is neither here nor there. It may not. But you know, just so everyone understands, that's the sort of environment that we were living in. And so the United States, they responded very fast. The operational deployment alpha guys, so Green Berets, went in with the Northern Alliance, and they rapidly ousted the Taliban, and primarily because Al Qaeda was being harboured by the Taliban, given safe haven, safe passage to plan and execute operations. Now, history doesn't show us whether we're right or wrong. That's just a fact of the matter. We don't know whether it was the right thing to do or not. But I can tell you from sort of my perspective, and I mean my perspective from sort of like an outside observer, we don't know if we would have been fighting Islamic fundamentalism in all of our capital cities, because we went to the heartland. It became like the Special Forces Olympics, Trent. All the special forces from the world converged there.
Yeah, it was the honeypot.
The honeypot theory, yeah. And so, so that's probably explains how that started.
Tell us about the Taliban.
Well,
what's your experience with those guys?
You know, I had some really... When the first round of guys from Special Air Service Regiment and 4-Hour Commando at the time went in there, we're talking big strapping lads, strong, a formidable fighting force. And when I went there in 2008, we were still cruising around in long-range patrol vehicles and special reconnaissance vehicles, so cut down. So the IED threat was still low. We were still getting into stoushes with them. And I remember we I don't want to go into too many details, but a couple of the people that we captured by force at night, you know, they were 6 foot tall, 100 kilo, jet black hair, the mascara, they were evil personified. You know, they come from the borders of Pakistan and Afghanistan, and they were formidable. Like, I wouldn't have beaten this person in a one-on-one fight in a room. You know, like they were evil, they were tough, really tough. And that wasn't the same, other than one event, which was Zabat Calais, that wasn't the same experience that I had in 2010, because primarily they were gone. They'd either been killed in detail, or they had, you know, they had disappeared to Quetta and we didn't see them again. We were fighting farm boys and we didn't want to. There was times when we stopped fighting because we realised we were fighting a low-level insurgency and not this, you know, huge... powerful army. So, and put it into perspective, and not many commentators are talking about this, but if you're somewhere for a generational war, if you're somewhere for 20 years and you're fighting people who are 30 years old when you first get there and they cease to exist, what's left after that now are 50-year-olds and they've been hiding in the hills. And so we hadn't, obviously we haven't done a really great job of showing them an alternative, because a lot of the Taliban rank and file are made up of people who are younger and they've seen freedom. And we'll get into that in a little bit of time. But not all is what it seems at the moment. Other than the very chaotic scenes that we're seeing at the airport, not everything is as it would seem. A lot of those high level fighters are gone. The others are old and past it. They've probably come out of the hills. So we're talking, if it's generational war, the 20-year-olds were 10 when we got there. No. They weren't even born.
Yeah.
You know, so generational war, it's going to be an interesting it's a different Taliban.
Yeah, it's a different Taliban for sure. Hey, one other point that I wanted to make is that there's no official information being used to put together our thoughts around this podcast as well. So
straight off the top of our heads.
So it's straight off the top of our heads. It's based on the commentary that you're seeing on social media. It's based on open source reporting that we're receiving, and obviously Bram's personal experiences. So that needs to be made quite clear. I noticed from some of the footage that we were seeing, given that we're probably only likely to see, you know, that point of view from us as Westerners, from maybe Al Jazeera or the Western media that is, you know, likely to be, you know, quite hunkered down. That's why there's a lot of footage around the airport and those sorts of things. We're not seeing what's going on out on the ground. We'll be getting reports for sure, but we're just not going to see the reality of what's happening.
Right. And, you know, if we talk about what's happening out there at the moment, there's still the Northern Alliance. The Taliban, you know, they can take over the country, but we have given, and I think the ADF, Australian Army, Australian Infantry and Special Forces as well, you know, all together have spent a lot of time building capacity and capability and showing an alternative. So there's a lot of men who would have fled that initial breakdown of the Afghan army, which by the way is close to 300,000 people. I mean, that's we're 65,000 in the Australian army. So the security apparatus is about 300,000. And so they've done, yeah, that might not be the right number for the Australian Defence Force, sorry.
No.
Australian Defence Force. And so, you know, 300,000 for the Afghan Defence Force that have just capitulated. And the president...
We'll talk about the Afghan security forces a little later. Okay. I think that's really important, yeah.
Yeah, well, let me finish with the Taliban. Yep. So finishing with the Taliban then, genuine capabilities, they're carrying around a lot of equipment that's captured American equipment. You know, PEC-2 lasers, you know, old M16s, M4s, so all old generational stuff. Stuff that needs an army's logistics behind it to keep it going. That's an Achilles heel. I don't even know it yet. Should stick with your 7.62s. And so a lot of that is just bluff and bravado. If you don't have that logistical support and train, you can't, you know, keep that stuff going. So interestingly, there is this group, there's this force, they've sort of come together under one banner, they're calling themselves the Taliban again, taking over the country. The rank and file is made up of younger, you know, generational people. Some of them would have been in the Afghan National Army, some of them would have been in the police force. They've seen freedoms. The ones that aren't in there, the Taliban may find themselves on the receiving end of an insurgency. Inshallah. Yeah. But, you know, and then they can see what that feels like. But there may, you know, we've given them, so the Australian Defence Force has given those people, the missions in Afghanistan have given those people a glimmer of hope, of freedom. And that sort of just simmers away.
They've seen it.
Just sort of simmers away underneath. And when that alternative isn't as great, when the alternative of Taliban rule isn't as great, that's when we're going to see unrest.
I think you've got something there. You know, this is not over.
No.
everyone thinks, you know, oh, well, we lost, we pulled out, we lost, they've taken over. It's not over. Right. The Taliban's going to face its own, as you said, its own counterinsurgency to some extent. And there's a reason behind that. And I think, as you've said, 20 years, they've seen what good can look like.
Yeah.
It's going to take some time.
Yeah.
But I think they'll also find, the Taliban's also going to find, most likely, that there's going to be power plays for control of the Taliban for sure.
Yeah. And
you said, they lack that
wisdom. Yeah. Mm. You don't beat, we didn't beat the, you know, we didn't beat the Taliban with guns.
That's right.
And you don't beat an insurgency with bombs and bullets. And sure, there was a lot of that going on, but it was a you beat an insurgency with an idea. And so what's going to happen is an idea will continue. The idea will never be gone now. The idea is there. You know, I hear a lot of social commentators at the moment, Trent, talking about, was it worth it, you know?
Yeah.
And, well, look, perhaps we'll wrap up with that at the end. Let's just go through a few other points before then.
Yeah. Hey, there's a lot going on social media at the moment, and there's a lot of people reaching out. In fact, even the Prime Minister of Australia reached out yesterday on a live session, which was broadcast on Facebook, talking about not only the COVID stuff that's going on in the background, and there's an element of, I think, COVID that played a part in part of our drawdown and when that all occurred as well. And I think the timing of the drawdown from a coalition perspective is interesting. We've done it in the middle of a fighting season. I'm not sure that was ideal.
Crazy.
Well, there's a lot of commentary around the mental health of veterans, and we're talking hundreds and hundreds of thousands across the world, but even here in Australia. And, you know, reach out if you're feeling, feeling stressed and those sorts of things. And I think there's a reality to that. And I think part of the objective of this particular podcast is to provide maybe a counterbalance to some of the negative commentary that's getting around on social media at the moment. So what are your thoughts around this mental health issue for veterans and this link to the fall of Saigon and those sorts of things?
Yeah, I echo your sentiment. If you feel depressed, you know, there's all these organisations out there that will help you to make sense of it. Now, you know me, Trent, not much knocks me for six. And like last weekend, I was a mess. I was like, oh, God sakes. Like it was tough to watch, tough to see, you know. And I had to put it into stark contrast for myself is that we went there to fight Islamic extremism. We went there to stop that nation, use that term loosely, that area being used by, you know, a real evil and threat. And it morphed into nation building. It wasn't meant to be nation building. It morphed into that because nation building is an amazing tool to provide an idea to counter an ideology. And so we sort of got wrapped into that. And I think people are forgetting that. Now, you know, someone asked me, was I worried about the fall of Afghanistan? And my response was pretty flippant, I guess. You know, a Spartan doesn't worry about the fall of another nation. Like, you worry about your own nation. Having said that, we've worked with a lot of people who were over there who I feel empathetic for. Actually, I sympathize with them. It's different, as you know. But I do think we need to take a step back and be non-emotive about this because we've done the job we were asked to go and do. We did that job. The Americans have decided to pull out. They haven't pulled out at what makes any sense for us the way they've strategically done it. So that's affecting a lot of veterans, I think. September 11 is deeply...
This was always going to happen, though.
September 11, 20-year anniversary, September 11, deeply symbolic. That wouldn't surprise me at all if that's what's going on in the background with this.
Absolutely. I think... to be honest, I think they were there. If I was the Taliban commander here, from an information operations perspective, I would absolutely be looking to time the fall of Kabul for the 20th anniversary.
Yeah,
I just I think, you know, surfaces and gaps and principles of the attack and all those sorts of things all went in their favour. I think this is a this was probably a brilliant plan, you know, executed with violence and done far quicker than even they expected.
Yeah, and so...
Which is the aim. Which is the aim of offensive operations.
Right. So I can just talk a bit more about the mental health aspect.
Yeah.
You know, my personal position is that the Army has given me so much more than I can ever give the Army back. I came from, you know, not much and made something of myself because of the experiences that the Army gave me, operational deployments, education, leadership training, friendships. And so for that, I'm thankful. I worked with some of the most amazing people had these operational experiences in Afghanistan. A few of them were bloody scary. A few of them were exhilarating. Amazing. And so for that, and I lost friends over there, you know, but they, and I've never said this on the podcast, but I know that those guys that were killed from 2nd Commando Regiment, knowing that their names are on the rock for all eternity, is solace to us. It's a solace. It's something to, you know, I won't say you're not trying to aspire to it or achieve it, but it's something that you know that if you lose your life fighting with the commando regiment, for instance, that you'll be remembered. And so it is with all of these units. I've got a rich history. You know, some of these infantry units have got incredible histories, you know. Now, I just want to, and it's so easy for me to say, but I just don't want people to let one experience or their time in the Army define them for the rest of their lives. And I don't want people to be victims to this. Like you can't, there's people jumping on, you know, I'm not going to mention names, but there's people who are dining out on this because they love the sound of their own voice talking about how much of a victim they are and how terrible the Army is. That Army gave you this platform, you know? And so if you're going to be the voice of a veteran, for instance, then be the voice of positivity, you know? Like talk about how great the ADF is, you know, because it has been wonderful to those people. And I just think there's a groundswell of people, Trent. I know this. There's a huge amount of people who listen to us, who watch the podcast, right, who are nothing but positive and they are not victims and they're just getting on with their lives and getting on with their jobs and they're toiling away after defence.
Yeah.
And they're positive. And all this white noise from a whole heap of people who are like, oh, what else can I get out of the Army after I leave, really muddies the water for the people who actually have post-traumatic stress, right? And there are people...
And the greatest majority of veterans are not only fully functioning, they're high-performing individuals.
Hell yeah. Yes.
High-performing individuals.
Yeah, there's infantry soldiers who were nothing before they joined the Army and now they're brilliant. They've left that experience, whether it's 6 years, 10 years, 20, they've left with that experience and they've become really exemplary Australians. And so for me...
soldiers and NCOs into know, project managers
and
leaders in all sorts of organisations.
So let's help those that have the mental health issues. Got it. It's tough.
Yeah.
Right? There's going to be a Royal Commission into veteran suicides, which I think is a great idea. Into any male, any female, any suicides should be... just suicide in general, for Christ's sake. Let's do a Royal Commission into that. Okay, but we need to start perpetuating a bit of positivity and all this is doing at the moment. And we were biding our time, you and I, to have this conversation around veterans.
Yeah, we have been.
Veterans stand up and be counted and be positive. Anyway. Oh, and triggered.
You know, aside from the fact, and I briefly touched on it, you know, the coalition forces have left in the middle of the fighting season.
Mm.
You know, we didn't do that well, in my view, and it was politically charged. And for one reason or another, that they are political decisions. Yeah. I get it. Let's not kid ourselves. And both the Democrats and Republicans have been trying to get out of Afghanistan for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And, you know, the numbers... if you track the numbers of, and I'm only talking about US troops here, in Afghanistan by year from 2001, you can see how it links with various policies. We were always going to leave, but it didn't have to happen this way, in my view. But I think it's deeply unfair, and I'm seeing a lot of commentary around the Afghanis. And, you know, they folded like a pack of cards and all of this negative, all of this negative stuff. Don't forget that the Afghani security forces lost over 66,000 people in this. You know, we've been fighting alongside them. They're the team that have been doing it without the armored vehicles, with, you know, for the most part, without the offensive, air support and all of those sorts of things, you know, without the CAS, without all of the PPE and the high level electronics that we're running with.
Yeah.
And you know, the Taliban has been
using an
information operations campaign.
Trent, just let me exclamation what you're saying there. And anyone who's on the line that was in Yankee platoon in 2010 knows this to be true. We had a dust storm come in, my company. We were in a valley. Dust storm came in. We were meant to be there for 48 hours. We ended up being there for the best part of 5 days. I think it was 5 days. Maybe it was a little bit shorter. And so we had no air support. And we were there on foot. And we had an enemy the same size as us. And, mate, like we were – they had our measure.
Yeah.
Tactically – you know, we're talking about the tactically best soldiers, best trained soldiers, you know, two commando regiment, best in the – you know, at least as good as the best in the world, fighting against Taliban and some of their other national advisors, right? Mate, they had our measure. We were on the ropes, and if it wasn't for those, if it wasn't for the dust lifting and the CH-47s coming to get us, so to think that the Afghan army, who are, you know, they don't have that training, they don't have that physical capability, they don't have that. They just, you know, no matter what we think, they're a different brand of human than us, right? And so, and the other thing too is we're putting Western constructs on an ancient peoples who are nomadic.
We're talking about first world armies have been going in to train and advise after the initial rout of the Taliban.
Yeah.
So first world armies that we've had hundreds of years to develop. Like hundreds of years in joint and coalition operations. You're talking about the Afghanis who are, you know, we're probably not even in, we haven't been even training them for 20 years. It's been less than that.
Yeah.
Because the mission morphed into training and advice.
Yeah,
right?
2000 sort of eight, I guess.
Right. So in all of that time, in what, the whole 12 years, there's this unrealistic expectation that these guys should have stood up and fought this, you know, high-powered enemy that's got significant amount of experience operating the way they do, and with very little support, an immense IO campaign, and speed of manoeuvre. What did we really expect? You know, they didn't choose the Taliban.
And if you think about the Taliban like COVID. Every time they were rolling through a village, their rank and file was getting filled with people who used to be in the army, who used to be in the police.
Well, there's
so they there's so that, so suddenly
photo getting around with the Taliban guys with the, you know,
right,
trigger discipline, and
so it's not fair to look at the, I mean, and their president did the runner.
Absolutely.
What do you make of that?
Expect when the generals left, and the, you know, they haven't had this generation after generation of development in a conventional army that we have. You know, the politicians left, the generals left. You know, no one to lead them. But what does anyone expect of them in that circumstance?
Yeah.
The majority of the Afghanis, there's people protesting today against the Taliban in the streets. The Taliban fired warning shots today, and when that didn't work, they resorted to actual violence, with two people killed, a dozen injured. And that's according to Al Jazeera at the moment. So there's still people in Kabul protesting against the Taliban. So they haven't chosen the Taliban. This has been imposed upon them.
Yeah, and as I said to you before, it's an amazing laboratory to witness leadership combat. And, You know, if leadership is compelling someone to do what you want them to do because they want to do it, you can't ask them to do something that you're then not going to do yourself. So if you take, you know, if you go and do a runner, then what do you expect? So very, very, very interesting. But as you've said before, it's not over by any stretch of the imagination. Now, you know, those guys who've gone over from all the different countries, guys and girls, I assume, to go and evacuate all the nationals and the like, you know, they're up against it. That's a really difficult task. Very difficult. 100%. Yeah, and again, our media, you know, media are sort of making a mockery of the fact they only had 26 people come out in the first C-130 last night. But, I mean, who was there? Like, who was there to get them out? How do you get them out if they can't get past the checkpoints? It's all well and good to say we'll give you safe passage out of the airport, but what if you can't get to the airport? Absolutely. And, you know,
what if you prevented from getting in the airport?
Everyone was surprised with the speed of which the nation fell, not least of which is, you know, probably the Afghan army itself. I'm sure there's pockets of resistance we don't even hear about.
Yeah, for sure. And there will still be leaders in this sort of, you know, counter-Taliban insurgency that are likely to try and fight on for some period of time. But, you know, going back to the position of the Afghan army at the time, and, you know, unfortunately they've had, you know, some of them have barely been paid. They're, you know, running low on ammunition because it's been siphoned off. You know, there was real issues right from the start that were exploited by, you know, what I would argue is just a classic information operations campaign.
Yeah, not necessarily coming from within Afghanistan either. And
that's right.
You know, just the usual
proxies.
The usual suspects, Iran, Pakistan, China. There's a lot of reasons for them to be happy to see this fail. If I'm going to be emotive about any of this, like emotionally upset by it, the thing that upsets me is, and I think you've written something here about the US longest war, which is Korea, and the troop commitment that still exists in South Korea.
28,000. There's still 28,000.
Yeah, and I just don't know why we didn't go for an advisory and maintain continuity and give them the thinking power, you know, the strategic power.
You know, I read something.
Or maybe we have. I don't know.
I read something yesterday. You know, we've been in Korea for decades.
Yeah.
Decades and decades. And, you know, we've genuinely made generational change there. Mm. I actually think that 20 years was not long enough. 20 years in Afghanistan was nowhere near long enough to get the generational change that we need.
It's not quite generational, is it?
No, it's not at all. You know, we've not built resilient institutions. We've not built, you know, government with good governance yet. It's too early.
Yeah.
You know, we've gone in and done missions even in the South Pacific that haven't had this history, and it's been difficult. And yet we expected it to happen. And I think this comes down to both political and community expectations that this is solely a military job.
Yep.
But this really highlights the limitations of military power.
You
know, you can't change an entire country just using people with guns.
No. And nor should we be seeking to change a country. And I often think that was part of the problem of the initial campaign plans, was to try and build something in our own image. So I think that was a failure of strategic thought. That, you know, what we should have been doing is rather than building a, you know, battalions and regiments and police forces and the like, was to, you know, to reach out and create warlords and fiefdoms along tribal lines. And as long as they were moderate and they were, you know, now listen, let me say this. One of the things I've often said, Trent, that you've heard me say it numerous times, and I've said it, you know, on this podcast, is if the world knew the way that women and children were being treated before September 11 in Afghanistan, we would have been there under a United Nations charter.
Right.
Western civilization would have not put up with that. And
do you think the world did, didn't know how they're being treated? I mean, we knew how they were living prior to the Taliban.
I don't think they knew the full extent of it.
The extent?
Oh, no. And I mean, if that is happening again, I'd be very surprised if the difference now, even now, between 2001 and 2021 is the access to digital data and the ease of which you can smuggle it out and the speed of which you can report things. That didn't exist 20 years ago. And so we will know. We will find out. They won't be able to stop that. And so technologies evolve and they speed up, and so the world will know. The world will see it. For sure.
Yeah, but will the world want to roll back into Afghanistan? And will the UN want to roll into Afghanistan?
Pick me, coach. There'll be plenty of people that would be quite happy to, because my grandfather's generation hated the Japanese because of what they did during, World War II. And I don't harbour that resentment, Trent. Mm. I don't have that resentment against those people at all. Like, I've friends who are Japanese, and I love Japan.
Yeah.
Same is not going to be said of the Taliban. You can't have a murderous organization saying that they are going to be moderate. It's not going to happen. So let's wait and see. I'm not even hopeful that that's going to be moderate. Jack Barry Woods, the government will not support it. Yeah, I agree. The government won't support it. Maybe Eric Prince will. I think that the United Nations has, it really is a toothless tiger in this sort of regard. We all worry about famine and the like and disease and, but where are we by upholding, just charters around freedoms,
or women's and children's rights.
I think that's what
women's and children's rights.
I've got to say, of all of this that's happening for the veteran community, I think that is the thing. That is actually the thing that is the hardest to reconcile. Is knowing that their lives are going to be pushed and subjugated. Sort of below, back into misery and below the threshold, for use of a better word. We're not going to see them, and so that's difficult for us to reconcile. However, we gave them 20 years of a leg up, and I do wish that the men had stayed the course and fought for their beliefs, because I know they believe in it. I know they believe in a free Afghanistan.
The Afghani men.
Yeah.
There's some commentary around that photo of the American C-17 with five times the number of people that the C-17 is sort of authorised to carry. And if you... Just to explain for those that haven't seen
nowhere near the weight, though, to be fair.
No, nowhere near the weight, right? Got that. But five times the number of people that it was authorised to carry. And there's a lot of commentary getting around at the moment saying that the majority of those people on that aircraft were men.
Right.
And sure, there was obviously a few women, particularly up the front of the photo with their head coverings and those sorts of things. What are your thoughts around how that, if that's true, how that may have transpired?
Oh, I mean, there's a lot of men there who are, terrified, I would assume, and they have the means and the ability to run for their lives. And the other thing too is just because, and it's such a Western sort of, where's all the women and children? Yeah. They're bloody hidden. And so the men are like, I'll get out and then I'll find a way to... I mean, you can't even imagine the terror on those families. Now, Yeah. Now, I mean, most of those men are linked to women and children, and now they're gone. Just put that in perspective. Yeah. You know, it's not what it looks like. It's not like it's just, you know, it's not white privilege. Let's put it that way. All right. You know, the women wouldn't have the ability to even move through the society like that after midnight.
Yeah.
Like it was just, and it was, they were terrible images. You know, those people clinging to the side of the C-17, such desperation. And that was hard to watch. And I wish they hadn't. Sometimes I wish the news would just go away.
Yeah, well, I think all of that contributes to the negative perception of the work that was done there. What do you think? Yeah. What do you think that 20 years in Afghanistan has done to Western nations?
Well, it's made us tough. It's made the Australian military tough, Australian army in particular. It's built our logistical ability. It's built our intelligence capabilities. Timor was a joke. Like, Timor made us soft. We started to fight an enemy where you couldn't use TTPs. You had to make stuff up on the fly. You had to be, had to have ingenuity, be ingenious.
I think there's probably different levels there of understanding. Because I think maybe from a tactical perspective, that might be true. But I think as you go up through the operational levels, there was a lot learnt in Timor that I think had we not gone to Timor at that time, you know, 1999 and onwards, had we not gone to Timor, I think rolling into Afghanistan and then Iraq would have been far more challenging. We would have not been able to pull it off as well as we did because we learnt those planning lessons at the higher levels, maybe the tactical levels. I think you're right. You're probably right. There was a lot to learn given that we hadn't done major operations with, you know, obviously UN activity prior to that, but certainly Timor at a different level was not the.
No, you're probably right.
There was some. Yeah, I think there was a lot learned.
Yeah, unfair comment. Lives. Yeah, it was an unfair comment. Yeah, no, you are right. Yeah, it was just. I guess it just wasn't scary. You know, it just wasn't walking around the tactical control line. Yeah, yeah. Whereas, you know, there was times in Afghanistan where, you know, myself and the guys were scared. You know. And you win, you know, and you toughen up, and you get on with it, and you carry injured people a long way, and you Kazovac people who are prior one, and you call in airstrikes. You call in 500-pound bombs, you know, 150, 200 meters in front of you at danger close, and you call in Apache gun trips and A-10s, and you know, and you go from a primary weapon to a secondary weapon. Like it was bloody hard work. It was terrifying, you know, and it created, and then at our sort of major and lieutenant colonel level, who are now, you know, generals, you know, red tabbers, like some of them have combat experience. And so they remember what it's like. We didn't have that in Timor, you know. You know, we had Cosgrove, who'd been to Vietnam, and a few people like that, but we didn't really have anyone is a lieutenant colonel or you know, a colonel who'd been in combat.
Right.
And so that creates a different type of army, creates a tougher army. You know, I look at some of my, you know, friends now, some of them are my commanding officers overseas. You know, just the pressure that I saw them under, just the pressure. And now they're generals and they're running things, you know, and they understand it. They understand battle rhythm. They understand how to synchronize effects. That's another thing, Trent. As soon as I said that word,
yeah, I know where you're going already.
You know, we watched it turn from, you know, synchronizing effects in the battle space in the last few years to a timeline-driven sort of Price Waterhouse Cooper consultancy, you know, exit strategy. Yeah.
Like having a McKinsey audit done on our operations, right?
Yeah, yeah. As opposed to let's get the following effects in place. And I think, you know, it made me realize in the last few weeks just how out of touch those planners were to draw down. You know, I mean, where was the big military show of force and operation? Where was the thing to scare the crap out of anyone who wanted to mess with the Afghan army? Where was the you know, where was the joint military exercise? you know, between NATO and the Afghanis rolling through, you know, Helmand Province on a, you know, like, where was that? None of that existed. They just poodle-faked around.
And that's where it comes down to the effects of politics and public will.
Yeah.
You know, 20 years is a long time in a Western construct.
Yeah.
Not in other constructs, but it's a long time in a Western construct where you've gone through four presidents or five presidents, I can't remember exactly.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And, you know, that's a long time, and the public gets tired of it. And don't get me wrong, you know, there's political commentary around, you know, we're sick of, you know, US blood being spilt and all of that sort of stuff. The last combat casualty in Afghanistan for the US was 16 months ago.
Really? Something else I was thinking about with what has happened to Afghanistan since we went in there was this exodus of talent. So,
right,
you know, capitalism requires growth. And so Australia, Canada, the UK, they all have to grow to continue to feed the capitalist beast. The minute your population stagnates, the dollar will fall. Like, you need to grow to, you know, there's, it can only happen for so long. Anyway.
Lukey's asked a question. Would we say it's partially due to a lack of connection between bureaucracy and the military forces in coordinating strategy?
Oh, I think this.
I mean, that's a twitchy place to go, given you know, our lack of exposure to that level of planning and.
I mean,
you know, experience is not there.
No, and I would consider myself a good tactical planner. I wouldn't put myself in the realm of the strategists who are sorting this out, and I don't know the pressure they're under from governments as an extension. So I don't know, but tactically, this is not what I would have been doing, but then again, I'm just a major, so what would I know? There's a lot of smart people out there who, you know, this probably surprised them too. And I mean, I've been inside a room with some of, you know, I remember being in a room in Hawaii with Special Operations Commander Pacific, you know, back in the day as the Australian sort of guy there, and I was there because I was pretty good, reasonably good. There was a couple of hundred officers in that room. I was the dumbest guy in that room. It's no doubt. When you've got a population the size of the US, you know, you're talking 150 special forces officers. I looked around going, geez, who's the dumb? Oh. You know, and you sort of realise pretty quickly that you're the stupidest person in the room, and it's just full of talent. So there's a lot of very, very smart people. Hey, I just want to finish that thought. Let me just finish that thought, mate, because I want to say 20 years there, we've been taking all of these people out of the country on, you know, visas to come to Australia as residents, and Canada and the UK. And we're taking the doctors and the lawyers and all the people who've been to university and all the academics and all the really, you know, all the really amazing people. And you just leave this void. You leave this void there. So we rob countries of their talent, and we bring that to our – now, and we're doing the same – I get it. I get why we're bringing the interpreters and we're bringing the people who worked with us. I get that, you know. But I would have just hoped that people would be like, you know, hey, I'm going to stand up here for Afghanistan. Now there is a guy in the Northern Alliance who's going to put up resistance. Sandhurst graduate speaks really well, and you know, watch this space, predicting it now. It's not over. No.
This is not over at all.
Do you want to take some questions?
I actually wanted to ask, what have we lost?
As in, what have we lost?
Now with the fall of Kabul and Afghanistan, what are we, okay, so clearly the Afghanis have lost, you know, a degree of freedom and control, right?
What has the West lost?
What's everybody else lost?
Oh, we've lost eyes and ears inside one of the most inhospitable places in the world where people can hide and train. That's the first thing we've lost. Yeah. The second thing we've lost is, you know, I'm going to try not to be emotional when I say this. We've lost the relationship and the love between Afghanistan and us. You know, we've lost, you know, this is a breakup. It's a very, very violent breakup, unfortunately. So we've lost connection with a new nation state.
An ally. This is an ally. We've lost an ally. That's, I think, first and foremost. What about?
Do you know what else we lost, Trent? Personally, I may go to jail for this one.
Oh, careful. You're one half of hindsight, mate.
We're a little tiny country. I don't know how to say this nicely. You know, how many people are we? 26 million?
26.
You know, and we've got this ally that we've had since we've left, since we left the sort of bosom of Great Britain. And that ally just showed that it's quite willing to pull out of somewhere when it doesn't suit them.
This is an interesting...
That terrifies me, mate.
And well, we're rolling around having different conversations about different parts of the world right now and commitment to future military operations. I get what you're saying, but I think that each engagement, call it an engagement, will be assessed on its merits for sure. Yeah. And I don't have the same degree of negativity that you do.
It's not negativity. It's just I'm just fearful of a United States that's going to go back into itself.
There's been an element of that probably since the last president, to be fair.
Hey, Stephanie's asked a question. How can I support?
Yeah, good question. I saw that as well.
How can I support my veteran friends? I truly have no idea what to say. I see their pain. It's hard for me to answer that because I've got conflicting ideas about the word veteran, and I don't want that narrative to get played out in here. I know there's a lot of people who are upset by this, as am I. I'm upset by it too, but. I don't want veterans to be dining out on this as if it's about them. This is about the Afghanis and how tough that is for them. And I think that the world is seeing that, not just the veterans. I think we're all looking at that going, gee, this is terrible. And those of us that went over there, you know, and loved our time over there and the people that we met and the like, you know, this is life. This is what, unfortunately, this is what happens. You can't control everything in your life. You have to be able to triage the stimulus that's coming in. You have to look at it as an outside observer and say, okay, well, these events are happening. You know, we did what we were asked to do by the government. We looked after our mates. We fought hard and we had to fight hard. And we did all we can do, but we don't control world events. And I think just letting people talk, you know, obviously the people who care about me, I don't really want their opinion. I just want to blurt out a whole heap of shit to them. What can you do? Best thing you can do is go and get vaccinated. That'll support everyone, so we can travel again.
I'll give you a.
Sorry, Steph. It's as good as I got. Yep.
I'll give you my perspective, Steph. For what it's worth, when I left Rwanda, which was back in '95.
Yeah, it was another millennium.
Yeah. Stop.
True.
when I left Rwanda in '95, it was after 6 months, and there was another rotation that came through 6 months after that. So we were there a total of 1 year. In that time, we'd only progressed the security and the safety of the Rwandan people so far. Now, 25, 26 years later, it's one of the fastest growing economies in the world. You know, things have changed, and that was, you know, the genocide of Rwanda was just one thing, and it was traumatic beyond belief. And the import that Australian soldiers, sailors, airmen and women had in that place, and the rest of the UN forces had in that place, had such a dramatic effect on the future of that country. And as we've said a couple of times already on this podcast, it's not over yet. And the effect that we've had, you know, whether it's that one person you helped, whether it was that one, you know, one person's wife that you rescued, or those children that you got out of a bombed out building or something like that, there are veterans who have done things and supported operations that people's lives have now been made better. And sure, they've still got a long way to go.
Yeah.
But we don't know what's going to happen 30 years from now.
No.
And so focus on what we did individually and as a collective.
Okay. So, Steph, just to finish on this, because I just read the rest of your second part of your question. My soldiers and I in 2010, so my second tour, we were really excited to go. Like, it was all I cared about. It's all they cared about. We trained for it for ages. We weren't forced to go there. And you couldn't have stopped me going, actually. Some of those guys did six tours. A couple of them did eight in 20 years. We bloody lived for it. Loved it. There's just something about having a pack, rifle, a trunk, all that equipment, you know, cut down Land Rovers, you know, parachuting in ammunition, getting in a gunfight that you just wouldn't, back then, you just wouldn't want to miss. So we wanted it. So guys that were killed doing that, 99% of the time they were doing what they bloody loved, right? And it's hard for spouses to hear that. You know, and they think they've died in vain because of this bullshit that's happening in the airport. Nothing could be further from the truth. Yeah, you know, they anyway, let's move on.
It's no different now. My son is a serving soldier now in one of the battalions, and you know, he was super keen, and you know, hoping they got called up as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. My son wants to join 2 Commando Regiment as well. So would I stop him? Hell no. Of course I wouldn't.
No, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Does anyone have any other questions that won't break me as much? Actually, I guess if I think about it from the government perspective, you know, world opinion may push this into, you know, may push us back in there faster than people think. I don't know, Trent. What do you think?
Well, I just don't know. I mean, there's a couple of questions here. You know, what's our future? You know, are we likely to recommit? I think the speed of this, it's a coin flip.
Yeah.
It's a coin flip. I think, you know, it will rely upon public pressure to force politicians to re-engage.
Yeah.
And that means, you know, public will to do so. And then you've got, you know, Steph's best friend, you know, who's going to argue that it's not worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it wasn't. So, you know, for her, it's not.
For her, it wasn't. Mm. But, you know, there's an entire country that's now, you know, got out from underneath the heels of the Taliban, at least for a brief moment.
Yeah.
And there's a whole generation now that can,
yeah,
that has seen what it could be like.
I mean, that's true, Trent. But that's not why we were there. I mean, that's just a good second order effect of that. The reason we were there was to stop us fighting Al Qaeda in the streets of Paris, London, Sydney, and New York, right? and we believe that we have the desired effect. And I think that if this Taliban proves themselves to be any way more moderate, it'll be a good thing. If Al Qaeda comes up there again, and I tell you what, if they reach outside that country and do anything, you know,
I'll get smacked again.
I think they will. I actually think they will. And technologies are changed now too. There's other ways and means. But you know, I just want everyone, I want any of the veterans who are listening or friends of veterans to know that this was, and I mean, General, you know, David Hurley, the Governor General, gave a, you know, speech. Public speaking's never been his strong point, you know, to be fair. So let me say this for the 42 people that are going to watch this. You know, at the end of the day, it was all about the mate to the left of you and the right of you. You did your job. You went over there. We kicked ass. Occasionally we got hurt. Occasionally we won. There were some Victoria Crosses awarded out of it, you know, which was an amazing thing, you know, for those guys. And at the end of the day, you know, it was really every kid's dreams to work operationally. Operators operating operationally, right? And so I think that we just have to remember that we most of us wanted to get in amongst it. And in doing so, you know, the majority of veterans are better people because of those experiences. They've learned things. They've been through really tough moments. You know, Dan Pronk talks about, you know, going through traumatic growth, you know, which is a really great way of explaining what it's like That's to go probably. Through that trauma and be better at the other side of it, you know. And I think that we really need to put a positive spin on this and see it for what it was. It was an amazing contribution by a brilliant, you know, Army Defence Force as well, you know, supporting it. And some of the stuff that happened over there that you'll hear about, no doubt in the future, will, you know, is quite incredible. Some of the stuff that we were able to achieve. Job well done. Now, you know, let's go and have a beer or something. I don't know.
Hey, well, it's not over yet.
It's going to be different.
One final question that I'm just taking. I'm going to combine JTR E621 and Marianne's question. So essentially, do we think that the growing tension in Southeast Asia or the, you know, South China Sea, do we think our withdrawal is linked to that? I mean, we're probably crystal balling here, given that we don't work in the Pentagon, the White House, or ADF headquarters, but, you know, would it have been best if we stayed or was leaving the only option? I've already indicated at the start of this particular podcast that I think that we didn't spend anywhere near enough time here. I think we needed to spend at least another 10 to 20 years in order to get that generational change. That's a hard pill for people to swallow because it doesn't come out of the barrel of a friendly person's gun. It comes out of, you know, building legal institutions and growing accountants and, you know, bringing governance into government. And that's where you get your nation's strength from, right? It's protected by a police force and an army, but it comes from something very different. And I've seen it done, and I've seen it done well in you know, the South Pacific.
Yeah.
So do we think it's part of this, or is it just weariness?
There's a lot in that to unpack. I like Chinese food. My kids learn Chinese at school. I look at China through a lens of trying to be Chinese. I don't look at it through a Western lens of negativity. I look at it for what it is. And it's a massive country with huge resource requirements. You can't mobilize an army like that. And it's being a little bit annoying or in the South China Sea, no doubt. I just don't think it's the threat that everyone thinks it is. I think it's a different threat. It's a long, slow, insidious, you know, just weighted numbers over time. Talk to any Brit about what that looks like. It just happens over time and the world changes. I don't think we're going to be invaded anytime soon. I don't think it works. I don't think it's going to work like that. Unfortunately, that's not the way the West deals with problems. So it'll be what it'll be. I don't really want to crystal ball it, because sometimes when you say those things, they come true, and they don't, and they shouldn't. But we say it, and then it becomes a reality. Samuel Huntington talked about the clash of civilizations, and the American military establishment needed a new enemy, and it just happened to become Islam, because he said it in a briefing. That was found on Osama bin Laden's computer, by the way, that thesis. So he was like, oh, we're the enemy? Okay. So I don't want to go and point fingers at who the next enemy's going to be for, you know, what can't we just all get along? And, you know, and I would hope that cryptographic currency is the answer to that, Trent. And we have globalization, and we spread across, you know, we can be different in our uniqueness in other countries, and we can look at different cultures, which is shared norms and behaviors, and look at them and go, wow, that's a really cool, what a really cool place, you know, that is. I like to go there for a holiday, but we're not the same. We're different. So that'd be kind of cool. But anyway, do I think we should have left Afghanistan? No, I don't. I don't. No, I just don't.
Me neither.
I don't. And I don't. And I don't. But I never agreed with trying to make them in our image. You know. And that was the fallacy, yeah. Though.
It's not the first time we've done that, though. As a civilization, and I don't mean Australia. I don't mean the US. As a civilization, it's not the first time. We've been doing it for a long period of time across all the empires. We just tend to do this, I think, because we're human.
Yeah.
And, you know, I go back to what I say all the time, just be a good human.
Yeah. Yeah, this was a bit of a tougher podcast than I sort of expected it to be, actually, because it's very emotive, and it's hard to take a step back and just look at it from an outside observer's point of view when you're so emotionally attached to the country. I'll tell you something, guys. And by guys, I mean everyone. Team. There you go, Trent. Gang. I'll tell you something, team. Gang.
Yeah. You read my LinkedIn post.
I did. I read all your posts. Most incredible scenery I've ever seen in the world was in Afghanistan. And, you know, that thing I always say to you when I put photos of a new dawn up is that I get to see another sunrise, and I first probably fell in love with watching the sun come up in Afghanistan. You know, the people there were amazing. The landscape's incredible. It would be an adventure junkie's playground if they could get tourism going. It's insane, like mountain biking. Oh my God. You know, we saw someone tour through there on bikes, I think, in the back of somewhere. Yeah, crazy.
I saw someone doing it in Iraq when I was there.
Maybe we should do that. Do you want to go to Afghanistan, you and I?
Well, that's a hard no, my friend.
No, come on. We'll get an old Lada Neva. I'll contact. I know some people in the Taliban. We'll get an old Lada Neva, and we'll just go from one side to the other, and we'll make a documentary.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, naked and alive. We could do the whole naked thing.
I'm not sure how alive you're going to be for how long.
I'm making a joke of it. I shouldn't. Incredible, incredible, beautiful country, and and I, like everyone else, we just watch now and watch things unfold, and not that I'm
not over.
You know, I wish very much for the safety of the Australians and all those who supported us, and we should bring who we can out, and I hope they get back safely. Yeah, but yeah, I watch with interest as well, Trent. No, please, no naked and alive. Thanks, Anne. all the crumpets. It's an in joke. Any other questions before we go, gang? Ask anything you want. I'll give you 10 seconds. Got 40 people typing away.
First one in gets it.
What do you got planned for the weekend, Trent?
Me? I'm working back in the green.
Good. Yeah.
Look Serious says, I'll go to Afghanistan with you, Bram. I've wanted to since I read James Mitchell's Caravans as a kid. Such a shame and a waste. Oh, there you go. Marianne's come back with, what can we do to help? Is there a reputable organisation we can donate to? Ooh.
Don't even know. I wouldn't even know.
Wait. Yeah. I would say wait. That's, you know, we need to see this unfold, diving in and making emotional decisions based on a stimulus right now may be counterproductive. So I think wait for a while and see what happens and see what opportunities open up. You certainly don't want to be helping the bad guys.
Yeah. Hey, thanks everyone who tuned into the Instagram Live. We're going to put this on our podcast this week. And I think, yeah, and we'll post this video as well so you can watch it again if you want. I certainly won't be watching it again. And then, yeah, so normal whatever will be resuming next week. Normal services, normal podcasts, normal podcast services will be returning next week. All right. Thanks, Trent.
One final thing, just when this goes up on Instagram, I'd be interested to get your feedback. We're thinking of doing more of these sorts of news-based sessions on the podcast going forward and, you know, talking about leadership and resilience and those sorts of things that's current and in the news and is topical at the time. So let us know what you think of this style of podcast, and we'll see if we can incorporate some you know, more of this stuff.
Normal programming. Thanks, Lukey. That's what I was looking for.
Normal programming.
Sorry, what do you make of the various ex-servicemen at odds with each other's opinions? I think I touched on that at the start. You know, everyone's an expert that's been there, including me, I guess. I just want people to be positive about their contribution to service to the country. And stop taking digs at everyone left, right and centre. Like, we just need to watch what's happening now. And yeah. Yeah, what else we got?
We all need to just get along. Apparently Jimmy reckons I need to have a vat of menthol.
Right. Smooth your voice out.
Thanks, Jimmy.
All right.
Radio voice.
Righto. I'm going for a run. Clearly.
See you later, team.
Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.